for Thursday, June 15, 2006. This is Free Speech Radio News. I'm Aura Bogado from KPFK in LA. Thousands of people make their way back to Oaxaca City to rebuild their encampment after yesterday's brutal police eviction. As the war in Iraq goes on debate in the House of Representatives, the Pentagon says the death toll of U.S. troops in the country reaches 2,500. And we'll hear about the debate behind Uganda's use of DDT in an attempt to control malaria. We'll bring you these stories and more after the headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the Free Speech Radio News headlines. A blast from a landmine killed at least 62 people in a crowded bus today in Sri Lanka. The government blamed the Tamil Tiger rebels for the deaths, something the group denies. Shortly after the bus explosion, the Sri Lankan Air Force began aerial bombardment in the northern part of the country. Today was the bloodiest day in Sri Lanka since a ceasefire came into effect 4 years ago. Nepal's government and Maoist rebels held a second round of peace talks today. PC Dobie has the details.
After 2 hours of talks in Nepal's Kathmandu Hotel, Maoist and government representatives reached a four-point agreement, including summit talks between their leaders and the formation of a UN-backed truce monitoring team. Some fear that Prime Minister Girija Prasad Koirala's statement yesterday that he favored a ceremonial monarchy would antagonize the Maoists. But today the fear was allayed with Maoist peace dialogue leader Krishna Bahadur Mahara stating that they would prefer to leave the fate of monarchy in the hands of the people during the election for the Constituent Assembly. At the conclusion of today's meeting, the two sides indicated that summit talks between the Prime Minister and the top rebel leader could happen as early as tomorrow. From Kathmandu, I'm PC Dubey for Free Speech Radio News.
A U.S. soldier who was arrested on Sunday at her mother's home in Eugene, Oregon, has been transferred to her unit stationed at Fort Lewis in Washington State. Mark Taylor Canfield reports.
Suzanne Swift served in Iraq for one tour with the 54th Military Police Company as a military police officer on combat patrol in Karbala. She returned to Fort Lewis in February of 2004, where she expected to spend the usual 18-month period between deployments. But the Army ordered her to report for redeployment 7 months early. Sarah Rich, Swift's mother, claims that her 21-year-old daughter has been diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder by a Eugene psychologist and that she was suicidal while serving in Iraq. She also claims that Suzanne wrote to her about being sexually harassed by Army staff. Former U.S. military desertions have resulted in various punitive measures by military authorities, including the loss of all military benefits, court-martial, and imprisonment for up to 5 years. The Army says her commanding officer has not yet made a decision on prosecution. The Pentagon says that 2,011 soldiers were reported absent without leave in 2005. This is Mark Taylor Canfield in Seattle, reporting for Free Speech Radio News.
The U.S. House of Representatives has again voted to end an administration requirement that Cuba pay in advance for U.S. farm goods. Matt Kay reports from Washington, D.C.
The House late yesterday voted to defy the White House for a second year and end a Treasury Department requirement Cuba pay for U.S. farm goods before they leave U.S. ports. Kansas Republican Jerry Moran.
And as a result of that, it has increased the cost of doing business with Cuba in a significant way. And in fact, we've had a significant reduction, 22% reduction in the sale of agriculture products since the adoption of that rule.
But Moran's amendment to block spending to enforce the rule has again drawn a White House veto threat against the Transportation Treasury HUD bill unless it's removed. The same threat last year killed the amendment then, even though the House and Senate agreed on identical language. In Washington, Matt Kay for Free Speech Radio News.
The Janitors for Justice campaign of the Service Employees International Union has organized 225,000 cleaning workers across the U.S. to commemorate Justice for Janitors Day on June 15th and to go public with an ongoing organizing drive. About 600 janitors and their supporters from several cities converged this week in New Haven, Connecticut. Melinda Tuhus reports.
They increase our workload without a simultaneous increase in wages, and if we complain, they say, there's the door, you can leave.
Marta Medina is one of 400 mostly Latino immigrant workers who toil in 45 buildings in the New Haven area, cleaning 10 million square feet of commercial office space daily. These workers currently earn $7.40 an hour with no benefits. Another problem is that night workers, mostly women, work only 3 or 4 hours a shift, so their wages add up to only $30 a night. Janitors organized in other cities by SEIU are scheduled to earn $10.50 an hour by next year and receive full medical and other benefits. After a rally on the New Haven Green, local janitors were joined by unionized janitors from neighboring cities, as well as local religious and labor leaders and politicians, for a march around downtown New Haven. Organizers say they hope cleaning contractors in New Haven will recognize the union by July 1st. Otherwise, the janitors will take a strike vote. For FSRN, I'm Melinda Tuhus in New Haven.
And I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
The death toll of U.S. troops in Iraq has reached 2,500, and the number of U.S. troops injured has surpassed 18,000. The Pentagon's numbers come on the day that the House of Representatives is debating the necessity of that war. Democrats are citing the war's pitfalls, while Republicans are defending the initial invasion. Washington editor Leanne Caldwell brings us more from that debate.
Despite new milestones of troop deaths, a series of events have assured that the war in Iraq will continue. The Senate finalized emergency funding that will allot an additional $66 billion to the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Republican Arlen Specter from Pennsylvania was the only senator to vote against it. Secondly, officials confirmed a replacement to al-Zarqawi. His name is al-Masri. And finally, the House of Representatives would not allow an amendment to be voted on that would require the president to create and implement a plan to exit Iraq. Instead, the House is debating an amendment that affirms that the U.S. will win the global war on terror, which includes the war in Iraq, and that the Congress will not set an arbitrary deadline for troop withdrawal. The House spent the day in debate. The Republicans focused on the war on terror, which they say is the same as the war in Iraq. House Speaker Dennis Hastert from Illinois.
As we watch some of our fellow citizens leap from burning buildings to their deaths, our fear turned to anger, and then anger to resolute determination. America's response started high above a cornfield in rural Pennsylvania. Brave men and women, armed with nothing more than boiling water, dinner forks, and broken bottles, stood up, as Americans always do, when our freedom is in peril, and they struck back.
And Republican Mike Rogers from Michigan.
Iraq is the central front on the war on terror. Despite what you hear, despite the pointing out of problems and a very difficult task, we ought not to be asking politicians here in Washington. We ought to listen to our enemy. Osama bin Laden, quote, "This third world war is raging in Iraq. The whole world is watching this war. It will end in victory and glory, or it will end in misery and humiliation." They have declared war against the United States and all those who seek to find democracy and peaceful solutions.
The Democrats, rather, focused on the war in Iraq, which they say is a different war than the war on terror. Democrat James Clyburn from South Carolina.
In Baghdad, in and around that part of the country, we see a failed policy. That is what is causing the problem in Iraq. We must begin to involve the Iraqi people in the reconstruction of their country. 85% of the country is without electricity. Almost 60% of the country is without drinking water. We're never going to be successful until we tackle these problems. And that is where we're failing, because there's no accountability on the domestic front in Iraq.
Democrat Ike Skelton from Missouri.
Rhetoric does not answer the problem. Only the Iraqis can solve the problem in Iraq. They're fighting with each other, and our troops are caught in between. And I say it's time to redeploy and be ready.
Visions of victory emerged throughout this debate. Again, Republican Representative Rogers.
Every great victory ends with our heads held high and safety and security for the United States. Let's not come home in humiliation. Let's not tell all of those families that their loved ones died in vain, because we have a November time frame and not a time frame for victory.
This war has gone on longer than the Korean War. It's gone on longer than World War I, and it's gone almost as long as the European War. If I believe we're making progress, we can't win this militarily. What I'm saying is to redeploy, to get our troops out of harm's way is the key. I see no progress at all in this operation. I see the opposite. When I see that you talk about al-Qaeda being encouraged by what we say, al-Qaeda's gone from 15,000 to 20,000.
And that was Democrat John Murtha from Pennsylvania. It is very likely that the resolution to win the war on terror will pass. Over in the Senate, meanwhile, Democratic Senator John Kerry from Massachusetts offered a measure that would require a timeline of withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq by year's end. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
The U.S. Senate voted on two amendments to the Defense Appropriations Bill today. Senators rejected an amendment introduced by Rick Santorum, which calls for sanctions on Iran and provides financial support to pro-democracy groups there. They voted in an amendment introduced by Joseph Biden that opts for diplomatic means to resolve the nuclear standoff with Iran. FSRN's Anastasia Genetsditska reports.
In today's discussions over Iran-related amendments to the Defense Appropriations Bill, senators outlined three possible ways that the United States could deal with the problem: militarily, diplomatically, or by applying sanctions. The solution proposed by Republican Senator Rick Santorum of Pennsylvania suggested the last option, namely imposing comprehensive sanctions that would potentially include Iran and other countries.
Impose additional sanctions, not on Iran, but on other entities that are doing business with Iran, and then try to impose a prohibition on importing into this country nuclear fuel assemblies made outside of this country if they do business with Iran. So companies would have to make a choice whether they want to do business with Iran or whether they want to do business with the United States. Part of the amendment directs the president to cut off foreign assistance to the host country of a company investing more than $20 million in Iran's energy sector. The final component of the legislation deals with what we call pro-democracy. This was really the key to this legislation.
Solution proposed by Senator Santorum was not approved by many in both the Democratic and Republican parties. In particular, Republican Senator Warner from Virginia criticized the consequences of sanctions on the United States' international relations.
The amendment runs counter to our efforts and those of the international community to present Iran with a clear choice regarding their nuclear ambitions. The amendment, if enacted, would shift unified international attention away from Iran's nuclear activities and create a rift between the United States and our closest international partners. Moreover, it would limit our diplomatic flexibility.
Republican Senator McCain of Arizona was unhappy about the source of funding for the pro-democracy programs in Iran.
As the Santorum Amendment took money from the U.S. military operating in Iraq, we don't want to do that.
Whereas the second Biden amendment.
The second one, Hagel and Biden. Yeah, I think it was reasonable and a good one.
The amendment proposed by Democrat Joseph Biden of Delaware ensures that the Department of State attempts to influence Iran through diplomatic means. It supports the incentives that six countries, including France, Germany, China, and Russia, have proposed to Iran in exchange for abandoning its nuclear program. So far, Iran has shown mixed signals in response to this proposition. According to Iran's foreign ministry, parts of the package were, quote, acceptable, but other parts were, quote, ambiguous. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Anastasia Gnezditska in Washington, D.C.
Public school teachers in Oaxaca, Mexico, have rebounded from the brutal crackdown against their protest encampment yesterday, mobilizing today along with various sectors of the Oaxacan population. At least 5,000 people have made their way back to Oaxaca City and are once again rebuilding their tent city. FSRN's Vladimir Flores reports.
Yesterday's deadly attack by state police against thousands of men, women, and children in downtown Oaxaca City hasn't shaken the conviction of the striking public school teachers. If anything, the outpouring of public support and outrage has added strength to their mobilizations. Municipal buildings in cities and towns throughout the state have been occupied in protest of the police actions. Teachers, along with students, housewives, and neighborhood residents, took back the city center of Oaxaca today after a retreat last night. The mobilization was broadcast live on the university radio station.
Today we are no longer alone. Besides the social organizations, students are demonstrating with us. In this very instant, the march in solidarity with the teachers is being accompanied by students from the state university. Also, marching along with the teachers are members of social organizations from the Mixtec region. More than 20 town hall buildings have been occupied throughout the state.
The university's radio station has played a key role in the past 36 hours, as it is the only broadcast media giving a voice to the movement since the police destroyed the teachers' radio station in the raid of the Union Hall yesterday. The station opened up its airways to a flood of callers yesterday morning, and it kept taking calls and in-person testimonies until it signed off last night. This teacher, who did not give her name, went in person to the station to tell the city what she witnessed on Wednesday morning.
It was completely brutal, the eviction that we were victims of. More than anyone, the women, because they grabbed us completely empty-handed. They grabbed us and threw us out with violence. Now we're hearing in the commercial radio stations that it was a peaceful evacuation. But we know that it wasn't like that. And we will come as often as is necessary to this station and then go out into the streets to communicate with the people about the eviction that we suffered.
Information regarding the exact number of dead, injured, and detained has yet to be confirmed. Figures range between 3 and 11 dead, but precise information is lacking. Sara Mendez of the Oaxacan Network for Human Rights comments on what is known about the wounded and detained.
Today's edition of Noticias is reporting 28 wounded. We also know that a large number of people were treated in hospitals. There are more than 70 people in the Red Cross alone. As for the detained, as of now, we have a list of 15 people, among them members of Radio Planton, as well as people from social organizations, teachers, and two members of the executive committee of the local teachers union.
Mendez goes on to say that yesterday's crackdown goes beyond the labor dispute between the teachers and the government. The teachers are calling on the Oaxacan population in general to participate in a mass mobilization tomorrow afternoon to condemn the deadly attack against the protest encampment and to call for the resignation of Governor Ulises Ruiz Ortiz. Oaxaca, Mexico, Vladimir Flores, Free Speech Radio News.
Ted Lewis is the Human Rights Director for Global Exchange. Lewis has just returned to the U.S. from a pre-elections observation trip to Mexico. He spoke with FSRN producer Monica Lopez about the potential effects of recent repressive operations in Mexico on the upcoming presidential elections.
We're talking about the upcoming Mexican elections in light of the recent repressive operations that have taken place in Mexico, in Atenco, and most recently in Oaxaca. Can you talk about what kind of effect actions like these would have just prior to a major presidential election?
Well, you know, it's hard to predict how the effect of this, what effect this will have on the presidential race. I was in Oaxaca last week and saw the massive presence of the teachers. They had more than 200,000 people in the streets just a few days prior to this attack. The effect of Atenco is one that I think, in terms of presidential politics, has gone two ways. On the one hand, it for those on the right and the people supporting the, you know, the strong hand of the mano firme policies of Felipe Calderón, who's running with the PAN and from the right, this is the kind of thing that they thrive on. It creates a sense of fear and uncertainty among the electorate, and it has split the left in some ways, because López Obrador, who's the center-left candidate, has been reluctant to embrace the protesters at Atenco, because they have been connected with the Zapatista other campaign. And so it's got an effect in the case of Atenco of putting pitting the left against the left, creating a climate of fear. This in general would favor the right. The situation in Oaxaca and the kind of massive repression, I think it's a little soon to call how that might affect things. In the recent presidential debate that took place just a little over a week ago, López Obrador was very clear about police should not be used, the army should not be used to repress the people, that they're supposed to be there to protect the people. And I think that he's spoken out again in that vein since the repression in Oaxaca. The repression in Oaxaca is quite massive, and the resistance of the teachers is not something that's going to go away. This is a teachers union that has literally been struggling with the state government of Oaxaca, which is still in the hands of the PRI. And that's important to recognize, that the old ruling party still rules the state of Oaxaca. They still rule the state of Mexico, where the Atenco atrocities took place. So you've got a very mixed bag of political actors here. It's hard to pinpoint who's responsible, other than the governor in Oaxaca. If there's any action from the federal level in this particular crackdown, it's hard to see. There were reports that plane loads of federal troops were going into Oaxaca yesterday, but now there's talk of a truce, and that there's a lot of pressure on the federal government to get involved in creating a space for dialogue. We hope that's what's going to happen, and it seems like the federal government is responding in that way because they realize that if there's a spiraling down of violence in the weeks right prior to the election, it really puts a stain on the Mexican process, and in turn puts a stain on the right-wing party that the government is currently ruled by.
In light of your recent trip to Mexico for elections observations, were there any particular hot spots that you have identified that election observers will be keeping an eye on?
There has been a standoff in the town of San Blas Atempa for the last 2 years around an electoral fraud. People in that town are threatening to boycott the elections, as the teachers union had already done last week. In addition, there's ongoing situations that have caused political prisoners over the last decade in Oaxaca, in places like San Agustin Los Siches. So certainly Oaxaca, with all of its special conditions, is a hot spot. Certainly the way voting will happen in Chiapas, in San Luis Potosi, and other areas are in question. But the state of Oaxaca, I think, is probably the biggest, what they call, foco rojo of the country right now.
Ted Lewis, thank you very much for joining us.
All right, thank you.
Ted Lewis is the human rights director for Global Exchange. He spoke with FSRN producer Monica Lopez. Countries in sub-Saharan Africa are still locked up over the debate on whether the pesticide DDT should be used to control malaria, which is currently one of the largest killers, especially among children, in the region. Malaria affects between 300 and 500 million people every year. The World Health Organization estimates that around 2 million people die of the infectious disease every year. 90% of those deaths occur in sub-Saharan Africa, mostly to children under the age of five. In Uganda, a pilot project of spraying DDT has started in one of the districts amid vigorous criticisms by environmentalists and other anti-DDT advocates. As Emmanuel Okello reports from Kampala, Uganda, preparations are in the final stages to spray DDT across the country.
As newer killers such as HIV and Asian bird flu grab headlines, this Asian parasite continues to reap its tragic harvest. Malaria kills one African child every 30 seconds. It's the biggest child killer in the region. A single bite from a mosquito is all it takes. World Health Organization says Uganda is among many countries in Africa that spend over 40% of their health facility budgets on buying medicine for malaria treatment. Poverty is a deterrent to even the most basic precautionary measures. Mosquito nets are beyond reach of many Ugandans. The nets cost about $6 each, while the average daily income among most Ugandans is $1 a day. Even treating malaria costs an average of $5 per patient. Although the use of DDT was banned in the United States in 1973, the insecticide is viewed by many political leaders in Uganda as a viable alternative. Uganda President Yoweri Museveni last week said consultations have been concluded to embark on the indoor spraying of DDT. Money to finance the project has been allocated in the 2006-2007 national budget. The budget will be ready for presentation in Parliament later this week. Dr. Sam Kibende of the Uganda Joint Clinical Research Center says there are no substantial scientific studies so far which prove that DDT is particularly deadly to humans or other primates.
You've got a lot of iron in your blood, and actually it's very good for you. Without it, you would die. Is that a problem? No. The presence of DDT in your blood should not be a problem. Actually, some researchers have shown that it can be very good for you. So it's not toxic. DDT has never killed anybody, ever. Actually, these drugs that we are peddling around, giving to people, kill more people than DDT has ever done. Let me give you an example of aspirin. Aspirin kills the biggest number of children in America today, but it cannot be banned because its efficacy, its usefulness outweighs its risks.
Professor Gabriel Bimenya is another researcher from Uganda's Makerere University Medical School. He says some agents in the Western world are fighting DDT usage for particular interests. He argues that the opponents of DDT usage are protecting the established market for malaria drugs.
They have got vested interests in malaria because some of these countries produce the antimalarials we continue consuming. Some of these countries produce tools to investigate malaria, like microscopes, like dyes we use to investigate malaria, etc., etc. And others are malicious about population control.
But those championing the anti-DDT campaign insist that the insecticide is toxic, and that's why it was globally banned about 40 years ago. Ken Luchamuzi, the vice president of Globe International, an environmental lobbyist group, says they are planning protests to decampaign the proposed spraying of DDT by the Uganda government.
DDT is one of the 21 toxins globally classified as persistent organic pollutants. Therefore, it is toxic in nature. It is a carcinogen. It can cause liver cancer. It can cause blindness. It can cause infertility. It can even damage the brains. And on top of that, I can challenge anybody in Uganda. Nobody has a right to subject toxicity on people without their mandate. DDT is very sophisticated in terms of fumes travel. It has the capacity to travel a distance beyond 3,000 miles. It could even affect people in Malawi or Botswana or Tanzania. Where do you get the moral authority to subject people to that level of toxicity?
Though some of its international partners in the health sector, like United States Agency for International Development, USAID, are still cynical about the project, Uganda says it's vigorously mobilizing funds to start off the spraying. The question, however, remains whether the exercise will not be a waste of time and money. There are reports that DDT has not aggressively been pursued in sub-Saharan Africa because of the continuous life cycle of mosquitoes and poor infrastructure. For Free Speech Radio News, Emmanuel Okela reporting from Kampala, Uganda.
Free Speech Radio News is a worker-run collective. Our newscast is produced by Simba Russo and Monica Lopez. Shannon Young is our headlines editor. DC editor is Leanne Caldwell. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Eric Klein and Antonio Ortiz. You can find archives of our newscast and documentaries online at fsrn.org. You can also email us your questions, comments, and story ideas to comments@fsrn.org. From KPFK in LA, I'm Ara Bogado.